not in a drunken stupor or crying in the corner, as he had been on more than one occasion. It looked like nothing at all, as if a human eye couldn't quite focus on what it was, though tonight it looked somehow more real than it had been before. Its hesitation, if it had hesitated at all, was only momentary. For the first time, Foran stood quietly as it enfolded him in its blackness, taking away his ability to move or cry out. He'd hoped that it would be better if he held still, but the burning pain of fangs piercing the inner skin of his elbow was as terrible as he remembered. Cold entered Foran from the place where the memory fed, as if it was replacing what it drank with ice. When it was done, it said the words that had become too familiar. "By the taking of your blood, I owe you one answer. Choose your question."
"Are you afraid of other people?" Foran asked. "Is that why you don't come if someone's in the room with me?"
"No," it said, and vanished. Shivering as if he'd been hunting in winter, Foran the 27th curled up on the rug on the floor of his room. Chapter 8. This time it wasn't the grating that opened, but the door. Tyr shot to his feet and had to stop there because the sudden light blinded him.
"If it please you, my lord," said a soft tenor voice that could have belonged equally well to a young man or a woman, "would you come with me? We have arranged for your comfort. I am to offer you also an apology for how you have been treated. We have not been ready to receive you until now."
Tyr wiped his eyes and squinted against the glare of what was, after all, a fairly dim lantern to see the backlit form of a woman. The sight, he could tell, was staged. She held the light carefully to exhibit certain aspects of her form. The slight tremor in the hand that held the lantern might be faked as well, but he'd have been worried about facing a man who'd been caged for as long as Tyr had, so he gave her the benefit of the doubt.
"I am no lord," he said at last. "Tell me just who it is I have to thank for my recent stay here."
"If it please you, sir," she said, "I'll take you to where all of your questions can be answered."
Tyr could have overpowered her, and would have if she had been a man. But if they, whoever they were, sent a woman to get him, it could only be because overpowering her would get him nowhere.
"You'll have to give me a moment," he said, "until I can see again."
As his vision cleared, he saw that the woman was arrayed in flowing garments that hinted broadly at the body beneath. A whore's costume, but this woman was no common whore. She was extraordinarily beautiful, even to a man who preferred his woman to be less soft and breakable. Even if the net of gems and gold that confined quite a bit of equally golden hair was paste and brass, and he wasn't at all sure it was, the cloth of her dress was worth a fair penny.
"Can you see yet, sir?" she asked.
"Oh, aye," he said congenially.
He'd bide his time until he had enough information to act.
"Lead on, fair lady."
She laughed gently at his address as she led him out into a winding corridor, behaving, he thought, as if he were a customer, rather than a man who'd been imprisoned for weeks. The hall ceiling was so low he could have easily touched it with a hand. On either side of his cell, there were doors that opened to his hand and revealed rooms that looked much like his. The woman was patient with him, waiting without murmuring and pausing with him when he stopped by an iron door twice as wide as the one that led into his cell. The door stuck fast when he tried it. The woman said nothing. When he took the lantern from her and adjusted it brighter so he could look more closely at the doors, she merely folded her arms under her full breasts. He ignored her until he was certain that the door was hinged on the other side, with two iron bars barely visible in the narrow space between door and frame, in place to keep the door shut. If he'd access to a forge, he could fashion something to unbar the door. But they were unlikely to allow him such. He handed the lantern back to his hostess and allowed her to lead him. The hall continued around a sharp bend and ended in double doors. Just before the walls ended, there was a door on either side. It was the left-hand door the woman opened, stepping back for him to precede her. The smell of steam and the sound of running water emerged from the opened door, so he was unsurprised to enter a bathing room. He knew what one looked like because the Sept of Gerant had held war conferences in his, saying that the sound of the water kept people from overhearing anything useful. But that austere chamber had as much to do with this one as a donkey had with a war horse. A golden tub of a size to accommodate 5 or 6 was brim full of hot, steaming water, with a tall table near it holding a variety of soaps and pots of lotion. But by far the most impressive part of the room was the cold pool. Water cascaded from an opening in the ceiling high above and poured onto a ledge of fitted rock where it was spread to fall in a wide sheet to the waist-deep pool below. He could tell the pool was waist-deep because there were 2 naked, frightened, and obviously cold women standing in it. Hissed his guide in sudden irritation. You look as if you are about to lose your virtue again. Does this look like a man who'd hurt women? She softened her voice to velvet and turned back to Tyr. You'll forgive them, my... Sir, our last guest was none too happy with his captivity and took it out on those who had nothing to do with it. He laughed with honest amusement.
After that speech, I would certainly feel like a stupid lout to try any such thing, he said.
In the brighter light of the bathing chamber, he could see that she was more than beautiful. She was fascinating, a woman who'd draw men's eyes when she was 80. He mentally upped her probable price again. So why was he being offered such service? The thought pulled the smile from his face.
So I'm to clean myself before being presented, eh? He said neutrally.
We will perform that service, sir, if you will allow us, she said, bowing her head in submission. When you are finished bathing, there are clean clothes to replace the ones you wear now. This is for your comfort entirely. If you choose, you may stay as you are, and I'll take you in now. I thought you would prefer not to appear at a disadvantage.
Disadvantage, eh?
He glanced at his clothes.
If they kidnap a man at the tail end of a 3-month hunt, they get as they deserve. I'll wash, but you ladies get yourselves out of here or my wife will have my head.
The women in the pool giggled as if he'd been witty, but they waited for a gesture from the woman he'd followed before they left the pool. They wrapped themselves in a couple of the bathing sheets folded in piles on a bench and exited the room through the same door he'd entered.
You too, lass, he told his guide. The highborn you serve may be comfortable with help, but we Redurni are competent to wash ourselves.
Smilingly, she bowed and left, shutting the door behind her. He hadn't noticed a latch, but he heard a click that could be nothing else, so he didn't bother to try the door. The waterfall was more intriguing. 4 leaps gave him a finger hold on the lowest ledge, and he climbed the rest with relative ease. When he found the opening the water fell through in the corner of the ceiling, it was grated with iron bars set in mortar. He slid back down and splashed uncaring of his battered clothing into the cold pool of water. He hadn't expected such an obvious way out, but he needed to know what he dealt with. Eventually, he'd manage a way out.
In the meantime, there was no need for filth. He washed the clothes on his body first, then threw them into the waiting hot tub, where he'd soaped down both them and himself when he was ready. The cold water poured over his face, clearing his head and his thoughts as he scraped away dirt. He hadn't heard anyone enter, but when he stepped out from the waterfall, there were clean clothes waiting for him. He ignored them and settled into the tub of hot water, soaped himself off, and gave rough service to his clothes. Rinsing everything in the cold pool, he draped his clothes where he could. Shivering now, he dried himself and examined the clothing she'd left for him. It was serviceable clothing, very like the filthy garments he'd taken off, though less worn. He fingered the shirt thoughtfully before donning it. The leather boots fit him as well as his old ones, lost somewhere during his captivity. As he tied the laces of his boots, his guide returned, her timing too accurate for guessing. Someone had been watching him. He hoped they enjoyed the show. She held a tray with a comb and a plain silver clip and held them out. He ran the comb through his hair and pulled it back into a queue which he fastened with the clip. He turned around once for her perusal, and she nodded. "You'll do, sir. If you'll follow me, the master awaits your presence."
"Master?" he asked.
But she'd given him all the information she intended to. "Come," she said, leading him back to the corridor. The double doors at the end of the hall were open this time, and a haze of smoke drifted into the corridor along with a desultory drumbeat and a hum of conversation. But he had only a moment to glance inside and get an impression of some sort of public room with tables and benches scattered around before the woman opened the door directly across from the bathing room and gestured him in. In size and lack of windows, the room resembled the cell Tyr had been living in, though here the stone floor was covered with a tightly woven rug that cushioned his feet. A pair of matching tapestries hung on one wall. The only furnishings in the room were two comfortable-looking chairs flanking a small, round table. In one of the chairs sat a man in a black velvet robe sipping from a goblet. He was a decade or so older than Tyr, with the features of an Eastern nobleman, wide-cheeked and flat-nosed. Like his face, his hands belonged to an aristocrat, long-fingered and bedecked with rings. He looked up when Tyr's guide softly cleared her throat. "Ah, thank you, Mirzaria," he said pleasantly, setting his goblet on the table. "That will be all." The door shut quietly behind Tyr's back, leaving the two men alone in the room. The robed man folded his hands contemplatively against his chin.
"You don't look like a traveler, Tyragan of Redurn." "Traveler?"
Tyr raised an eyebrow and took the empty chair. It was a little short for him, so he stretched out his legs and crossed his ankles. When he was comfortable, he looked at the man most probably responsible for his recent imprisonment and said courteously,
"And you don't look like a festering pustule on a slug's hind end, either. Appearances can be deceiving."
The other man's face didn't change, but Tyr felt a pulse of power, of magic, just as he was meant to. The surge of magic died, and the wizard smiled.
"You are angry, aren't you? I do believe we owe you an apology for keeping you locked in your cell. But it has been a long time since we had an owl in our keeping. We had to be certain that we could contain your magic before releasing you."
Contain his magic?
"You seem to know a lot about me," Tyr commented. "Would you care to return the favor?"
The other man laughed.
"You will have to excuse me. You're not quite what I expected.
I am Kristang, Sept of Telleridge." Tyr nodded slowly. And what would the Sept of Telleridge want with a Redurney farmer?
Nothing at all, said Telleridge. I do, however, have a use for a traveler and bard.
I told you, said Tyr mildly. I am not a traveler. What do you need me for?
Telleridge smiled as if Tyr's answer had pleased him. In addition to my duties as a sept, I find myself with the delicate charge of the youth of the Empire. The law of primogeniture, however necessary, leaves many of the younger sons of noblemen without any constructive outlets for their energies. I run an eyrie for these lost young men, and I'm responsible for their entertainment.
I'm the entertainment, said Tyr. Surely there are bards who don't need abducting to be persuaded to provide entertainment.
Telleridge laughed, but they would not be nearly as amusing. The laughter drifted away as if it had never been. Nor would they be Owl. All you need to know at the moment is that you are, will you or nill you, my guest for the next year. During that time, you will entertain my young friends and occasionally participate in our ceremonies. In return, you may ask for anything that you wish, short of leaving, and it will be arranged.
I don't think so, said Tyr.
Refusing is not an option, said the wizard. For a year and a day, you will have whatever you want, or you can struggle. It matters not one whit to me. That phrase struck a chord of memory.
A year and a day, Tyr said. You'll make me beggar king for a year and a day?
He hummed a bit of the old tune.
And I suppose, like the beggar king, you'll sacrifice me to the gods at the end?
That's right, said the wizard, as if Tyr were a prized pupil. I see that an owl will be different than a raven, which is what we've had the last 3 times. The hunter was interesting, though we finally had to cage him. I think you'll do. But first... He leaned forward and touched Tyr lightly. As he did so, the silver and onyx ring on his index finger caught Tyr's attention briefly. He was distracted by the ring when the wizard's voice dropped a full octave, and he said in the traveler tongue,
By Lark and Raven, I bind you that you will harm neither me nor any wizard who wears a black cloak in these halls. By Cormorant and Owl, I bind you that you will not ask anyone to help you escape. By Falcon, I bind you that you will not speak of your death.
Magic surged through Tyr, holding him still until the wizard was done. There, he said, sitting back again.
There indeed, thought Tyr, shaken.
No one had ever laid a spell on him before. He felt violated and frightened. It had been so fast, and he hadn't been able to defend himself from it at all. Cold sweat slid down his neck and he shivered, fighting nausea. Sick? Telleridge asked. It takes some people like that, but I couldn't depend upon the word of a traveler peasant, even if you'd give it. My young friends are easily influenced. I would hate to lose any of my passerines too soon.
Passerines?
Asked Tyr, breathing shallowly through his nose and hoping he didn't look as shaken as he felt.
You have songbirds here?
The wizard smiled. As I said, a bard will be interesting. Mirceria will tell you what you need to know about my passerines. Ask her about the secret path if you wish. She is waiting for you outside the door. The woman was indeed waiting for him, kneeling on the cold stone of the floor with her hands at rest, prepared, Tyr thought, to deal with a man in any mood he might emerge with.
She sat unmoving until he closed the door gently behind him.
If you like, I can take you into the Eyrie, she said, using her right arm to indicate the open double doors. There are others to talk to if you wish, and food and drink are available to you there. If you would prefer to ask me questions, we can go back to your room. You will find it much improved.
Let's go talk, he said after a moment.
As Merceria promised, the cell had been transformed in his absence. It had been scoured clean and furnished with a bed such as the nobles slept in, rather than the rush-stuffed mattress over stretched rope he had at home. Rich fabrics and rare woods filled the room. It should have looked crowded, but it managed to appear cozy instead. In the center of the bed, a worn lute rested, looking oddly out of place. He took a step toward it, but stopped. He wasn't like Seraph. He didn't feel the need to do the opposite of whatever anyone tried to get him to do. But that didn't mean he enjoyed being manipulated either. So he left the lute for later examination, and chose to investigate another oddity. The room was lit by glowing stones in copper braziers placed in strategic places around the room. They're quite safe, said Merceria behind him. She moved against him, pressing close until her breasts rested against his back, then reached around him to pick the fist-sized rock out of the brazier he'd picked up. He set the brazier down gently and stepped away from her.
You are quite lovely, lass, he said. But if you knew my wife, you'd know that she'd take my liver and eat it in front of my quivering body if I ever betrayed her.
She is not here, Merceria murmured, replacing the rock and turning gracefully in a circle so that he could see what he was refusing. She will never know.
I don't underestimate my wife, he replied. Nor should you.
Merceria touched the net that confined her hair and shook her head, freeing waves of gold to cascade down her back and touch her ankles.
She'll believe you're dead, she said. They have arranged for it. Will she be faithful to you if you are dead?
Seraph thought he was dead. He needed to get home.
Telleridge said you would answer my questions, he said. Where are we?
In the palace, she answered.
In Taella?
That's right. She leaned into him. He bent until his face was close to hers.
No, he said softly. You have answers to my questions, and that is all I'm interested in.
There was a flash of fear in her eyes, and it occurred to him that a whore was hardly likely to be so interested in him on her own.
You can tell Telleridge whatever you like about tonight. I'll not deny it, but I'll not break the vows I've made. I have my own woman. I need answers.
She stood very still for a moment, her eyes unreadable, which told him more about what she was thinking than the facile, convenient expressions of a whore. Slowly, but not seductively, she rebound her hair. When she was finished, she had tucked away her potent sexuality as well.
Very well, she said. What would you like to know?
Tell me a lie, he said.
Her eyebrows raised. A lie?
Anything. Tell me that the coverlet is blue.
The coverlet is blue?
Nothing.
He felt nothing.
Tell me it's green, he said.
The coverlet is green.
He couldn't tell when she was lying. Just about the only useful thing his magic could do. He opened his mouth to ask her to help him escape, just to see if he could. But no word of his request left his throat.
Gods take him! He roared angrily. Gods take him and eat his spleen while he yet lives!
He turned toward the whore and she flinched away from him needlessly. He had himself under control now.
Tell me about this place. The Passerines, the Secret Path, Telleridge. All of it.
She took a step back and sat gingerly on the edge of the bed, on the far side of the lute. Speaking quickly, she said, The Secret Path is a clandestine organization of nobles. The rooms that you have seen today and a few others are under an unused wing of the palace. Most of the activities of the path involve only the young men, the Passerines. The older members and the masters, the wizards, direct what those activities are. The Passerines are the younger members of the Secret Path. They are brought in between the ages of 16 and 20.
What do they call the older members? Asked Tyr.
Raptors, she replied, relaxing a little. And the wizards are the masters.
Who is in charge? The wizards or the raptors?
The High Path, which is made up of a select group of raptors and masters, and led by Master Telleridge.
What is the requirement for membership? He asked.
Noble birth and the proper temperament. None of them can be direct heirs of the septs. Most of the boys come at the recommendation of the other Passerines.
Telleridge is a sept, said Tyr, trying to put his knowledge into an acceptable pattern.
Yes. His father and brothers died of plague.
Did he start this secret path?
No.
She settled more comfortably against the wall. It is a very old association, over 250 years old.
Tyr thought back over the history of the Empire.
After the Third Civil War.
Mircea nodded her head and smiled a little.
For Anne the 18th, I believe, who inherited right in the middle of the war when his father was killed by an assassin, he said. A man known for his brilliance and diplomacy rather than war. Now, what exactly was it that caused that war?
Her smile widened. I imagine you know quite well. Bards, I've been told, have to know their history.
The younger sons of a number of the more powerful septs seized their fathers' or brothers' lands illegally while the septs were meeting in council. They claimed that the laws of primogeniture were wrong, robbing younger sons of their proper inheritance. The war lasted 20 years.
23, she corrected mildly.
I bet the path was founded by Foran the 18th's younger brother, the war leader.
She cleared her throat. By Foran's youngest son, actually, although his brother was one of the original members.
The path, said Tyr, having found the pattern, draws the younger sons. Young men educated to wield power, but who will never have any. Only the ones who are angriest at their lot in life are allowed into it. As young men, they are given a secret way to defy those in power, a safe outlet for their energies. Then, I suppose, a few are guided slowly into places where they can gain power, advisor to the king, merchant, diplomat, places where they acquire power and an investment in the health of the empire they despise. Old Foran the 18th was a master strategist.
You are well educated for a baker, she said, from a little village in the middle of nowhere. He smiled at her.
I fought under the Sept of Gerand from the time I was 15 until the last war was over. He has a reputation as being something of an eccentric. He wasn't concerned with the birth of his commanders, but he did think that his commanders needed to know as much about politics and history as they knew about war.
A soldier? She considered the idea. I'd forgotten that. They didn't seem to consider it to be of much importance.
You are well-educated for your position as well, he said.
If younger sons have no place in the Empire, their daughters have.
She stopped abruptly and took a step backward. Why am I telling you this? Her voice shook in unfeigned fear. You're not supposed to be able to work magic here. They said that you couldn't.
I'm working no magic, he said.
I have to go, she said, and left the cell. She didn't, he noticed, forget to shut and bolt the door. When she was gone, he pulled his legs up on the bed, boots and all, and leaned against the wall. Whatever the path was supposed to have been, he doubted that its only purpose was to keep the young nobles occupied. Telleridge didn't strike him as the sort to serve anyone except himself, certainly not the stability of the empire. Thinking of Telleridge reminded Tyr of what the wizard had done to him. His magic was really gone. Not that it was likely to do him much good in a situation like this. Alone, without witnesses, Tyr sat on the bed and buried his head in his hands, seeing once more Telleridge's hand closing on his arm. Wizards weren't supposed to be able to cast spells like that. They had to make potions and draw symbols. He'd seen them do it. Only ravens were able to cast spells with words. Telleridge had spoken in the traveler tongue. Tyr straightened up and stared at one of the glowing braziers without seeing it. That ring. He had seen that ring before, the night he'd met Seraph. Though it had been 20 years, he was certain he was not mistaken. He'd a knack for remembering things, and the ring Telleridge had worn had the same notch on the setting that the ring... What had his name been? Resson. Resson had been a wizard too, a wizard following Seraph. How had Telleridge known that Tyr was barred? Tyr had supposed that his unknown visitor had told the wizard, if it hadn't been the wizard himself. However, it sounded as if Tyr being a bard was the reason they'd taken him in the first place. No one except Seraph knew what he was, though she'd told him that any raven would know. They had been watching him. Mirceria had known that he had been a baker and a soldier. Had they been watching him and Seraph for 20 years? Were they watching Seraph now? He sprang to his feet and paced. He had to get home. When an hour of fruitless thought left him still in the locked cell, he settled back on the bed and took up the lute absently. All he could do was be ready for an opportunity to escape as it presented itself. He noticed the tune that he'd begun fingering with wry amusement. Almost defiantly, he plucked out the chorus with quick-fingered precision. A year and a day, a year and a day, and the beggar'll be king for a year and a day. In the song, in order to stop a decade-long drought, desperate priests decided that the ultimate sacrifice had to be made. The most important person in the nation had to be sacrificed, the king. Unwilling to die, the king refused, but proposed the priest take one of the beggars from the street. The king would step down from office for a year and let the beggar be king. The priests argued that a year was not long enough, so they made the beggar king for a year and a day. The drought ended with the final, willing sacrifice of the young man who'd proved more worthy than the real king. Just as the Secret Path's traveler king, Tyr, would die at the end of his reign. He thought of one of the bindings Telleridge had put on him. The young men, the Passerines, didn't know he would die. Otherwise, there would be no reason to forbid him to speak of it with them. No doubt, then, his death would serve a purpose greater than mimicking an old song. Would it appease the gods like the beggar king's sacrifice in the story? But then why hide it from the young men? What would a wizard want with his death? Magic and death, he remembered Seraph telling him once. Magic and death are a very powerful combination. The better the mage knows the victim, the stronger the magic he can work. The mage's pet cat works better than a stray. A friend better than an enemy. A friend for a year and a day. He had to get word to Seraph. He had to warn her to protect the children. His fingers picked out the chords to an old war song. Mirceria, he thought.
I will work on Mirceria.
Foran held the bundle of parchment triumphantly as he marched alone through the halls of the palace toward his study. They'd look for him in his rooms first, he thought. No one but the old librarian knew about the study. They'd find him eventually, but not until he was ready for them. It had been impulse, really. When the old fool Duver set down the papers the Council of Seps had for him to sign, Foran had just picked them up, tucked them under his arm, and announced to the almost empty room that he would take them under advisement. He'd turned on his heel and walked out, slipping through a complex system of secret passages, some of which were so well known they might be corridors, and others he rather thought he might be the only one who knew. He'd given no one a chance to follow him. For most of his life, he'd signed what they told him to. At least his uncle had done him the courtesy of explaining what he'd signed, though he remembered not caring much about most of it. But the empty room had been an insult. When the Emperor signed the proposals into law twice a year, there should be people present, and would have been if anyone thought that the Emperor would do anything but sign what he was told. He entered the library through a secondary door, passed unnoticed among the bins of parchment and shelves of books in the back corner of the room, and unlocked the door of his study. It was a small room, but it locked from the inside as well as the outside, which was all that he required. He settled himself into his chair and thought. It was all very well to decide to be emperor in fact as well as name, but he didn't really have the support he needed. The Sept of Gorish fancied himself de facto ruler, and the Septs who followed him, Telleridge and the like, would do their best to fight any sign of independence. Really, he'd best sign the damn things and get it over with. Instead, he uncorked his inkwell, trimmed his pens, and began to read. The first three parchments he signed, complex trade agreements between various Septs, and nothing the Emperor should interfere with. Almost involuntarily, he made mental notes of the names involved and the alliances the new laws revealed. The fourth parchment was another of the increasingly punitive laws aimed at the travelers. He signed that one, too. Most travelers were thieves, his uncle had said, though not without a certain amount of sympathy. Having no land they could settle on because no sept would have allowed such a thing, they were forced to earn their bread as best they could. Hours passed. Occasionally, Foran would sneak out to the library to retrieve maps or books. But he signed the parchments one by one, setting only a few aside for further review. Two he found that might serve his point. They were regional matters that most of the council would not care unduly about. Each was signed by only a few more than half the council, with no protests. The first act would give the Sept of Hala exclusive fishing rights in Lake Azalon. Foran had checked his maps and found Lake Azalon to be a small body of water in the Sept of Hala's lands. The law was so odd. The Septs usually had effective exclusive rights to any fully enclosed body of water, that Foran knew there was a story behind the ruling. The second concerned a small section of land awarded to the Sept of Jenna for his services to the Empire. He pored over the simple words to mine them for clues and regretted the indifference that had kept him from the council the past few years, because he no longer knew all of the different alliances. Geography helped. All of Hala's signatures were from Septs in the northeast, Hala's neighbors. All except one of his neighbors. The one, thought Foran with sudden comprehension, who had been sending fishermen into his neighbor's lake. That one would work. Hala had little influence in the council, but he'd rather come down on the side of justice. The second one was frustrating because the land in question was so small that he couldn't find out much about it. He looked up from a map, and the memory was there. He hadn't realized how long he'd been in his study. He'd trimmed the lamps absently as he'd needed, and there was no window to tell him that the sun had set. Slowly, Foran set his pen down and shed the heavy state robes so he could bare his arm. The hope that had cloaked him for most of the day evaporated at the touch of cold, cold lips on his skin. It hurt, and he looked away as it fed. "By the taking of your blood, I owe you one answer. Choose your question." Tired beyond reason, and still trembling with the remnants of pain, Foran laughed harshly and said,
"Do you know someone who could help me understand what's so special about a small slice of the Sept of Jarant's lands that the Council would gift it to the Sept of Jenna?"
The memory turned and drifted toward the door.
"I thought you owed me an answer," said Foran without heat.
That would have taken too much passion, and he'd already really given up on his plans. He would not hurt an innocent man just because his petition was convenient for his purposes, and he was beginning to believe that the library did not contain the information he needed to refuse to sign Jenna's petition. He'd already begun to go back to comparing two well-drawn maps to a third, less clear but more detailed, when the memory said, "Come." Foran looked up and saw it waiting for him. It took him a moment to remember exactly what he'd asked.
"You know someone who could help?"
It didn't answer. Foran stared at it and tried to think. If anyone saw him. He glanced at the parchments and maps scattered around and gathered the ones that might prove helpful.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Chapter 9. They came for him shortly after Mircea left. Tyr set the lute down and stood up when the door opened to admit five men in black robes like the one Telleridge had worn. Their hoods were pulled down over their faces, and they walked in as if they each had a predetermined place to stand. Tyr had the oddest feeling that they did not see him at all. They took up positions around him. One after the other they began chanting, a low, droning, off-pitch sound that he could not decipher because the words they used belonged to no language he'd ever heard. Magic, he knew, but he was helpless to stop them because of Telleridge's command. As one, they raised their hands above their heads and clapped. He awoke lying on the floor, naked and sweating. The memory of pain lent nausea to the cacophony of tingling body parts. He sat up, frantically trying to remember what had happened after the wizards had clapped their hands, but the thought of the sound made his ears ring. They had taken his memories. Even so, there were things that he knew, as if the events he couldn't remember had left a visceral residue on his body. He'd been violated, not physically raped, but something that was a near kin. He sat up straight and held his head like a wolf scenting a hare. He remembered that, remembered someone telling him, remembered Telleridge telling him, that he would not know what had happened. Owls had very good memories. Tyr's lips drew back in a snarl. Hatred was a foreign emotion to him. He'd fought for years against an enemy he was told to hate, but he'd never found anything in his heart but a grim determination to persevere. The Fallarn were not wicked, just wrongly ambitious. He had seen people do terrible things because of stupidity, ignorance, anger, but he'd never met evil before. Now, he was befouled by it. Staggering to his feet, he looked for his clothing. When he was clothed, he could feel less vulnerable. They'd taken his memories and his magic, but surely they would leave him clothes. A cursory search of the room turned up a tunic and pants, though not his own. They were looser in fit than he was used to, and darker colored. Traveler clothes for their pet traveler. Nevertheless, he pulled them on quickly. Instinctively, he looked for something he could use to clean himself, and noticed there was no water in the room. Even as he regretted the lack, he knew that it wouldn't have mattered if they'd left him in the bathing room. The filth that coated him could not be cleaned that way. His gaze fell upon the lute. No matter how fine the instrument, a lute always needed tuning. He sat down beside it and cradled it to him. There were 8 courses on this instrument, 2 strings per course except for the highest note, and this lute hadn't been properly tuned in a while. As he settled into the familiar chore, the shaky, frightened feeling in his stomach began to settle. He tightened pegs by slight movements because there were no extra strings sitting around if he broke one. As the lute started to come up to tune, he noticed that the man who'd set the fretting had had an ear as good as his own. Perhaps he'd been a bard, too. He tried a simple refrain and knew in a rush of relief that this was what he'd needed. For a long time, he just played bits of this and that, letting the music salve the hurt that had been done to him. At last, his fingers hit upon a tune that his ears enjoyed, a piece his grandfather had written to welcome the coming of spring. He closed his eyes and let the music fill him until everything else was distant, where it could no longer harm him. He took a deep breath that filled his lungs with the scent of lilacs. Magic. He opened his eyes, stilled his hands, and took another breath. The scent had faded, but he could still smell the sweet flowers until his sinuses closed. His eyes watered, and he sneezed twice. Lilacs always made him sneeze. Perhaps, he thought. They don't know as much about traveler magic as they think they do. There was a scuffle outside his door, as if someone fumbled with a key.
Drat, said a young man's voice. Drat, drat. This key is supposed to open any door in the palace. Wait, a turnkey box.
There was some more rustling and a jangle of keys rattling together. The door of his cell creaked open.
Hello?
A rather pudgy young face peered around the edge of the door.
Hello?
Tyr said mildly, though his body was tense and ready to act.
Look, I hope I didn't wake you, or... Your light was still on, so I thought...
The young man stumbled to a halt.
Come in,
invited Tyr genially.
Keys, he thought, lowering his eyelids. This boy would be no...
He rolled to his feet abruptly.
What in the name of the 7 flaming hells is that?
The boy looked over his shoulder at the dark, nebulous shape behind him for a moment.
You can see it?
He asked, sounding unhappy.
Most people can't. It calls itself a memory. As if that's a name. I haven't figured it out exactly myself. It doesn't usually linger like this.
As the thing moved into the room, Tyr took a step back from the overwhelming presence it carried with it. He sat back on his bed and tried to look peaceful.
I'm sorry, the boy apologized.
Tyr turned his attention back to him with an effort and noticed for the first time the quality of the clothes he was wearing. Velvet, embroidered in heavy metal threads that looked as if they were really gold.
Look, said the boy again. I don't know why you're here. These aren't the regular holding cells, but for some reason...
He gave an odd, short laugh.
I think you might help me with a problem I've been looking into.
And the boy took a piece of parchment he'd been holding and thrust it at Tyr. He sat beside him on the bed, started to point at something, and then stopped.
Do you read? He asked. Not to be offensive, you understand, but you're dressed like...
I can read common, said Tyr. He'd learned under the sept of Geraint, making him one of the double handful of people who could read in Redurn. Since the memory, whatever that was, had decided to stay on the far side of the cell, Tyr allowed himself to look more closely at the writing on the parchment.
Look here, said the boy, sounding more authoritative. This is nominally just a simple award for a job well done. Except that usually properties that belong to one sept aren't gifted to another. Certainly not with a vague, for services to the Empire, see?
Tyr looked at what he held with disbelief. It appeared to be a law document of some sort. First, Tyr had thought that the boy might be one of Telleridge's wizards, especially with the thing that had followed him in. Then, he'd been almost certain that he was one of the Passerines Myrsaria had told him about. Now, he cleared his throat.
Are you a member of the Secret Path? If I'm not, does that mean you can't tell me the answer?
The disingenuous answer made Tyr laugh in spite of his generally lousy mood. The young man gave him a pleased smile.
Actually, I've never heard of the Secret Path. Though, if you put any three nobles together, they'll start four secret societies of something.
Tyr nodded his head slowly.
I'd been given the impression that the Path members had taken over this bit of the palace and made it their own. If you're not one, how did you find your way here?
The boy shrugged.
The palace has enough rooms to house the whole city and then some. The first 15 emperors, Foran, spent all their time building the place. And the next 10 tried to figure out what to do with all the rooms. Mostly close them up. At least two of them, the 8th and the 14th, or the 7th and the 13th, if you'd rather not give a number to the first Foran, were fascinated by secret rooms and passages. By happy chance, I stumbled upon the plans of 8 and actively sought 14s. Once I had them, I hid them myself. At any rate, they give me ready access to most of the palace. Not that there's usually much to see.
I see, said Tyr, rather dazzled by all the 8s who might have been 7s.
There was a song in that somewhere. He hadn't really thought about how the Path had managed to secret off such a big chunk of building. He had a hard time wrapping his mind around a building so large that the Path could use a section for generations and not have it discovered.
I'm not a lawyer, Tyr said finally. Nor do I know anything about the septs. I don't see how I can help you.
The boy frowned.
I asked if there was someone who could help me find out more about the piece of land in question. Is there any reason that you would know something about the Sept of Geraint's lands?
The Sept of Geraint?
Exclaimed Tyr, distracted from the question of who knew enough to send this boy after him.
That's right, said the boy. I don't know him by face, but it sounds as if you've met him.
He'll not have been at court, murmured Tyr, reading the rest of the document rapidly. He's an old warrior, not fitted for wearing silks and such. The Sept of Jenna,
I have this, if it helps, said the boy,
and he pulled a small, faded map from a pocket.
I can show you where the land in question is. I just don't know what's so important about it.
The soft hand that handed Tyr a map had a signet ring on it. Tyr noticed and catalogued it, but he was thinking about the map, so it took him a moment before he realized who was sitting on his bed beside him. The Emperor? His knight had acquired a new level of strangeness. Tyr glanced at the memory. Was it some sort of bodyguard? He forced his eyes back to the map. If the Emperor had wanted him to know who he was talking to, he would have introduced himself. The boy tapped a spot on the old map.
That's where it is. It doesn't even connect to Jenna's lands.
Tyr closed his eyes and thought back 20 years, trying to make the lines on the map correspond to the land he had known rather well at one time.
Water rights, he said finally.
That's the headwaters of the creek that gives Jurant's people water. This piece of land belongs to the Sept of Jenna's father-in-law, or it did 20 years ago. The current Sept might be the son or grandson of the man I'm thinking of, but at any rate, the land's in Jenna's family's hands. It's pretty useless despite its size, because it's in the rain shadow of Brulis Mountain. Won't grow anything but sagebrush. If Jenna had control of Brulis, that strip of map should be marked to show the mountain. He could hire a wizard to divert the flow of water and send it down the other side of the mountain, or find some way of diverting the small river that runs on the wrong side for their purposes.
Ha! The boy exclaimed happily. It's a payoff! That's the one I want, then. What can you tell me about Jurant's allies?
Tyr hesitated.
Jurant's a good man, he said.
The boy raised an eyebrow.
I'm not planning on hurting him.
Now it was his turn to hesitate.
I suspect, said Tyr softly, that there's a law or two against a common man like me sharing a seat with the Emperor. If you've a need to be incognito, it might be better to take off that ring.
Foran. Doubtless the boy's name was Foran, though Tyr couldn't remember the number that went with the name. Looked upset for a moment, glanced at the ring that was the Emperor's seal, then shrugged.
I'll keep your advice in mind. Well enough. If you know that much, look here.
He tapped the paper impatiently.
I need something I can use as a fulcrum to move the power structure in the Council of Septs so that I don't continue to be just a figurehead. And this document is it. It was in my twice-yearly stack of petitions to be signed into law. There aren't many signatures on this, only a few people who owed Jenna something. Like as not, most of them didn't know what it was they were signing. You can't even tell that this land is Jurant's without this map.
Right, said Tyr.
He hadn't realized that the boy was a figurehead. But then he hadn't concerned himself with any news outside of Redurn, since he'd left Jurant's services several years before the last Foran died.
26th,
he said aloud.
Only if you don't count the first Foran, said Foran,
not the least discomposed.
I like to, though my father didn't. Are you still with me?
Right, Tyr nodded.
You have a bill, obviously a favor, but not for a Sept who is very powerful. So if you decide to decline to sign it, you're not going to make a slew of enemies. Who could object to your refusal to grant one Sept's lands to another without better reason than you've been given? And I'll put up my right arm that Jurant is no traitor or mischief-maker that will embarrass you on this. He's true as oak. So you refuse to sign it, and the rest of the council either supports you, or makes it look like they think the council should have the right to take land from whatever Sept they want, without giving an adequate reason.
That's it, said the boy, gathering up his map and document. And I have a toehold into ruling on my own. So, you have done me a favor.
Carefully, he folded the parchment so it fit into his pocket with the map.
I owe you an equal favor. Before I determine how best to repay you, tell me what you are doing here, what this path that I'm not a member of is, and what the two have to do with each other.
It's faster if I start with the path, said Tyr after thinking about it for a minute. The rest of the story should fall out of that.
Briefly, he outlined the information Telleridge and Mircearia had given him. Foran stopped him.
They kill the traveler wizards for power? These wizards who wear black robes?
Tyr nodded.
So I'm told. I've only met two people, three with you, since I was brought here.
He thought the ladies in the bath didn't count.
I haven't actually seen any of this for myself.
You still haven't told me what you were doing here, said Foran. Or who you are, other than someone who fought under Jurant in the last war.
I am a farmer who occasionally sings for a few coppers at the local tavern in Redurn.
Tyr said.
I usually spend the winter months trapping for furs. I was on my way home.
I have a vague memory of seeing a group of strangers, and then I awoke in this cell. Telleridge, that's the man I told you about.
Telleridge, said Foran.